Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Monday, January 9th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear an update on where things stand with federal student loan forgiveness ahead of Supreme Court oral arguments next month. And CityCast Denver takes us underground to find out more about the history of the tunnels under the Mile High City. After the BBC News headlines, we'll hear the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. Then it's Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Longo-Better. Her guest today is Tony Garcia from Denver's Su Teatro. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Cal Huss will be in the Denver studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first the headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Denver workers, labor unions, and organizers with Colorado Jobs with Justice are rallying for wage justice today. The groups are gathering outside the Denver City Council second floor rotunda at 8:30 this morning to urge council members to support an ordinance giving Denver Labor the authority to assist workers in recovering promised wages, including the city's minimum wage. Organizers say the new local bill would create an additional, more accessible mechanism for workers to recover their stolen wages. It would also authorize Denver Labor to levy substantial penalties on employers who violate the city's labor laws or refuse to pay the city's minimum wage. The mayors for Chicago and New York urged Colorado Governor Jared Polis by letter on Saturday to halt the state's practice of busing migrants to their cities. The joint letter said that although they shared concerns of accommodating the flood of asylum seekers, overburdening other cities is not the solution. Polis said in a press release Saturday he had a very productive discussion with the mayors and said the state had no more scheduled buses to Chicago and had scheduled the final chartered transportation to New York City yesterday. According to Polis, Colorado was in the process of scaling back migrant transportation, citing nationwide travel returning to status quo because of the holidays and the impact of weather. In Polis's press release, the governor said the Biden-Harris administration must assist states in accommodating new arrivals and provide a legal framework for them. Domestic violence in Colorado accounted for at least 91 deaths in 2021, according to a recent report. KGNU's Benita Lee has more.
The Colorado Domestic Violence Fatality Review Board, headed by Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser, released findings Friday that show domestic violence deaths rose 44% in 2021. Of 91 deaths, at least 45 victims were killed by intimate partners, 32 were perpetrators, and 14 were bystanders. Of the bystanders, 4 were children. Weiser says this was the highest number of fatalities from domestic violence since the board was created in 2017. Consistent with past findings, most victims were female and most perpetrators were male. In over 80% of cases, guns were the weapons used, and the deaths occurred mostly in rural counties, also typical of prior years. The board is recommending policy changes to address the issue. This includes expanding training for judges so they can make decisions in court cases that might prevent future fatalities. The board also recommends funding to offer more equitable access to domestic violence resources and services. Current state law requires authorities to ask perpetrators subject to protection orders to relinquish their guns. However, it's not often enforced. The board recommends stronger strategies to ensure guns are removed to assure public safety. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
An avalanche killed 2 men who were snowmobiling in the backcountry near Winter Park Saturday. Both men were in their 50s and residents of northern Colorado. The Grand County Sheriff's Office says emergency responders located one of the men who was wearing an avalanche receiver, but pronounced him deceased after resuscitation efforts failed. Rescue crews found the second victim the next day. Saturday's avalanche is the third this winter to kill recreationists in the backcountry. Emergency response personnel for Boulder County say the county is working to streamline the process of public notifications for natural disasters. The Daily Camera reports evacuation notices for the December Sunshine Wildland fire from the county and the city of Boulder had different warnings and orders, creating confusion for residents, especially for residents just west of the city limits. Emergency management personnel say the city of Boulder used the new mapping tool Zone Haven for the first time during the December fire, which they say worked well, but the county had not completed coordination rollout with the agencies it works with to be on the new system. Emergency crews relied on the prior standard map for county areas of the fire. Officials told the Daily Camera that although there was confusion for public evacuation information, the new countywide system put in place after the Marshall fire for crews to identify and tag areas for evacuation went smoother from an operational standpoint. The United States Environmental Protection Agency announced the agency is awarding small businesses in Lafayette and Lakewood with $100,000 each to develop promising environmental technologies. The two Colorado businesses are among 25 nationwide to receive award money from the agency as proof of concept funding for their proposed technologies. According to an EPA news release, Lafayette-based Sporian Microsystems, Inc. will use the research funding to develop a high-speed, low-cost imaging system to identify microplastics in the environment, whereas Lakewood-based J-Tech LLC is working on a technology that enables a low-cost, chemical-free, and sustainable disinfection of wastewater in septic tanks for non-potable reuse, such as irrigation. If the companies complete their proof of concept, they can apply for additional award money to further develop and commercialize their technologies. For today's weather, the National Weather Service says skies will be mostly sunny with today's highs in the 50s. Winds could gust as high as 20 miles per hour for Denver. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with lows in the upper 20s with winds gusting as high as 18 miles per hour. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule on the Biden administration's plan for student debt relief by early summer. In the meantime, federal student loan repayments have been paused until 60 days after the court's ruling. This measure could offer $10,000 in student debt relief to those with qualifying incomes, and twice that amount to qualifying Pell Grant recipients. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Dr. Nicholas Hillman, professor in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about student debt and the status of the Federal Loan Forgiveness Program.
Can you catch us up on what's happening with student debt in the U.S.? Is it being forgiven? Is it not? If so, how much and for how long?
There are probably three big things happening right now. The first is that federal loans have been paused for about 3 years now. And that means that if you have certain federal student loans, you haven't been having to make a payment and interest has been at 0% during that period of time. And so that pause is going to end and it's unclear exactly when it's going to end. The Supreme Court on February 28th will hear the initial arguments from the Biden administration and the plaintiffs in the constitutionality of debt forgiveness. And that is a big question mark of where the court will land. And then the third piece of this is just how do we kind of re-enter repayment? It was one thing to shut the system off. It's a whole different thing to turn it back on.
What is going to happen if they turn back on and when they turn back on? Is it a when?
It is a when. And there will still be loans to be repaid when it turns back on. And that's because the forgiveness that the Biden administration is planning to give caps how much is forgiven. $20,000 is the maximum. $10,000 is what most borrowers would get. And there are income criteria and application processes. So basically, there will be loans left over to be repaid. And those are basically going to pick up where borrowers left off prior to the pause. And interest will not have been accumulated during that time.
Who are the people that President Biden is trying to get loan forgiveness for? Who would be let off the hook and in what way?
So in terms of who would benefit from forgiveness, you know, there are a couple different groups that I think I could say with confidence. The first group would be actually a very sizable portion of federal student loan borrowers, about 20 million out of the 40-so million borrowers would have their debts forgiven completely because most borrowers carry less than $20,000 in student loan debt. A lot of individuals would benefit from relatively small forgiveness. However, on the other side, you have folks who maybe went to medical school, law school, and graduate school and accumulated $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 in student loan debt, $10,000 or $20,000 of a cancellation isn't really going to help them a lot in the long term.
Huh. What would you tell a baby boomer to help them fully understand the scope of debt that younger generations, you know, millennials and Gen Zs are carrying with the student loan debt? Because I think that, you know, a lot of different generations don't quite understand.
Yeah, there are some figures about sort of how much does it take to pay for college these days compared to when, you know, folks went, say, in the 60s and 70s. And it's just a different world, completely different way of paying for college, way more responsibility on the individual. The student loan program has doubled in just, gosh, maybe even tripled in just the past 10, 15 years or so. In the early 1990s, there was a couple of different things happening. A lot of states were trying to keep their tax revenues relatively low. And there were a lot of taxpayer bill of rights types of policies that basically constrained how much money states can generate from their tax bases. And higher education kind of became first on the chopping blocks because you could basically pass those costs onto the consumer by charging higher tuition. And so this has been a long time in the making. The 80s and 90s really ramped up a lot of that state divestment, I suppose, and put a lot more pressure on individual students to pay for college and their families. But another thing happened. The federal government loosened their standards on who could borrow. And so the federal government kind of opened up student lending at the same time that states were putting more responsibility on individuals to pay for college. And so it's really swelled. The Great Recession in 2007 through 2009 flooded a lot of people back into college with very little financial resources, and they had to use loans to pay for college and to pursue the American dream, to do what they're told to do, go to college and things will be better. And so the way to do it today is by using loans. And so that's really the main financial channel that students use today to pay for college. Nowadays, a typical college graduate has about $30,000 in student loan debt, and about two-thirds of all undergraduates who get a bachelor's degree borrow. So I hope that gives a little bit of a sense of the scale.
Yeah. So the Congressional Budget Office estimates that forgiving student loan debt will cost around $400 billion over 30 years, with a bulk of those effects on the economy over the next decade. Who are the people who are going to be left with the bill if these loans are not fulfilled?
You know, that's a question I also have. And I don't think I have a good answer on that, unfortunately. I would be stretching if I did, frankly.
So we don't even know who this money is going to?
Well, we know who it go to, but we don't know what it means in terms of like who pays for it. Because you could think of it as like a credit that's due that's just not coming in. Like the revenue that you're getting from the loan or that you're planning to get from the loan, it's designed to basically sustain the federal government's lending program. And I don't understand how the implications of forgiveness would affect that. And that's a CBO question for sure.
What does it mean to the economy if these debts aren't forgiven? What impact will that have?
In terms of the racial wealth gap, I think that there are some serious implications here. The racial wealth gap is not closing, and student loan forgiveness was one way to make a little bit of a dent in that gap. It certainly would never clear that gap, would it close that gap by itself, but it is an effort to reduce some of that racial wealth gap. And so without cancellation, we can expect that racial wealth gap to continue to persist. That's one factor. There are probably several more, but that is definitely one to keep on our radars.
Dr. Hillman, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Next time you find yourself in Denver's Lodo neighborhood or wandering around near Union Station, look down. Just below the streets of downtown, there's a maze of old, out-of-commission tunnels that used to connect hotels, restaurants, and stores of yore. Glimpses of these alternative pathways still exist at street level if you know where to look. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies talks with Tracy Beach, author of The Tunnels Under Our Feet, Colorado's Forgotten Hollow Sidewalks, about this turn of the last century phenomenon.
So Tracy, I understand there are tunnels under downtown Denver. Can you start by telling me, where are they?
Well, actually, there's a lot of tunnels that are underneath Denver. They go all around the downtown area. They were used for numerous things. The one thing I always tell people when they're looking for tunnels is, don't look at what it is, look at what it used to be. So for example, outside the Oxford Hotel, you'll notice that there's open areas with little guardrails all the way around them where you can look down from the sidewalk and you can see the basement level where the beauty shops are and stuff outside the Oxford. Those are the tunnels. They took up the sidewalk. They put up the railings to allow light and air to get into their basement levels, which now have like a doctor's office and beauty shops and things. Those are your tunnels.
Okay.
Those actually go partially underneath the street. Now, you have to remember the trolleys ran in the center of the street. So you cannot have a tunnel that goes all the way across except for at an intersection. That's why these tunnels would be up to the point in which the trolley was, because the trolley has a mound and it has to be sturdy. So they had these stone walls on each side of where the trolley tracks were. Now, that's when the tunnel started being destroyed, was because we went from horse and buggies and Model Ts to UPS trucks and semis. So at each of those intersections where it was weakest, because that's where it had the tunnel that crossed at the intersection, they were starting to collapse from the weight of the trucks. At that point is when they started to shut down the intersection tunnels because they were collapsing. That was in the 1950s.
So how did you find out about them?
There was actually a map that I was able to get hold of from a man named Kenton Forrest. He worked at the Golden Train Museum. He has since passed, and he gifted it to me. His father actually was one of the people who worked on the tunnel system and laid the tile inside of it and things like that. He heard all of his stories from his father and why they started closing up the tunnels. And then he also was able to get a photo that I was able to use, two of them actually, of the Union Depot tunnels. And then also one of them of the tunnel that ran from the Windsor.
So you mentioned that these are like tiled, these are like legitimate, like these were legitimately built tunnels.
Yes, they were about 10 feet wide and over 10 feet tall. They were used so that people could walk around town. If you think about it, you have these fancy hotels like the Oxford, the Windsor, stuff like that. And back in the day, the roads were dirt and there was horses, and horses do what horses do. And there was that and mud and everything everywhere. Well, the elites don't want to be sitting there and leaving the train station in their pretty fancy shoes and their pretty fancy dresses. So what they would do is with these tunnels is there was horse and buggies underneath the tunnels. There were stables in the tunnel system that were in the basements of different buildings. That's where the horses were stabled, was in the basements of buildings.
What?
And there's a map in my book that Kenton Forrest gifted me that shows the location of one of those stables. So people would go and they would simply load up into the little carriages and they would put all their luggage in there and they would be taken to their hotels. And there was below ground beauty shops, below ground everything. And they would simply turn the horses around, head back, turn it back around, and just go back and forth. So the elite didn't have to mess with all the mess and the horse yuckies and everything up top.
Yeah, you're painting the accurate picture that we often don't have when we we look at like Victorian, you know, or like Gilded Age Denver, for instance.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, horses, as you're saying, make poop, and cities were kind of stinky and dirty. And
yeah.
And you mentioned there was like beauty shops and other amenities.
Yes.
So it was like a second city in some senses below the city.
Yes. Well, this is really, really common back in the day, because you have to understand that everybody wants to be on the main streets. Everybody wants their business to be seen right there. That's why in England is where it started really. And then when they came across the pond, they just brought it with them. So the one thing that they would do is, since everybody wanted to be on the main street, they simply would have the first floor, the second floor, and then they would go and have the basement level would be below ground shops. Then that way they would have stairs that would go down to these below ground shops. Then that way people could have more businesses on the main street.
Okay.
And then some of them where you would take the staircase down from the sidewalk, like you see in New York, staircase down, and then you would just walk all underneath the sidewalks and hit the different stores.
So you mentioned like folks would get off the train and then, you know, ride to, for instance, the Brown Palace. Where else would these tunnels go?
Well, you have to understand that it's like, There was a time in which there was the big, huge fight where they were burning down the Chinese areas in Denver.
You're talking about the racist anti-Chinese riots of 1880, right?
Yes. Now, what had happened during those anti-Chinese riots was the Chinese, of course, were supplying a lot of the restaurants. They were doing the cooking. They were the cooks. They were also doing the laundry and the housekeeping. So at the time of the Chinese riots and everything, the Chinese had to go underground. Now, of course, these tunnels already existed. So what they did was the hotels and the restaurants still needed those people to come and do their services, but they didn't want to be seen entering the building. So they would simply, they moved their shops into the below ground areas. They would have the laundromats and the things like that. And they would just simply push the, say, the laundry carts and stuff through the tunnels to each hotel to pick up the laundry.
Wow. So, okay. So Asian folks and maybe other immigrants who are doing this like kind of behind the scenes labor are utilizing these tunnels.
Yes.
Folks are utilizing them for travel. I just have to assume sex workers were also, and their clients and customers were utilizing these tunnels as well.
Yes. Now on Market Street, which used to be called Holiday Street, that's where they had a lot of the brothels, you know, like Maddie's House of Mirrors, which was originally owned by Jeannie Rogers. And then when Jeannie Rogers died, I believe of kidney failure, her competition, Maddie Silks, purchased her brothel. And then as spite toward Jeannie Rogers, Maddie Silks then went and put her name in tile at the front entrance as kind of like, haha, I now can step over you and now I own your place. But those areas all had tunnels so that people could go and they could sneak in and they could not be seen. But when I was working on my Laura Evans biography, Laura Evans she worked for Jeannie Rogers at one point, and she also then became a madam in her own right for 50 years in Salida. She talked about in her diaries about how people were warned not to use the tunnels in regards to the brothels because men would get jumped and stabbed and robbed in those by other men and by some of the women.
Whoa. You know, Denver, in comparison to other cities around the world, is not a very old city, but this has me thinking about this sort of once thriving underground life below Denver. What makes you so fascinated in these spaces below our city?
Well, when I was working on my biography about Laura Evans, I got a hold of her diaries. Now, I was raised in Salida. She had an entire red light district that she took care of, a whole block with two brothels, numerous cribs. They had parties every single night up and down the street, people dancing. It must have been awesome. So I got a hold of her diaries, and she had mentioned that there was tunnels underneath the sidewalks in Salida. Well, I had never heard of it. But a lot of the Laura Evans things had gone hush-hush when I was growing up. So I went down to the museum and I was like, hey, where are these tunnels? And they go, oh, it's a rumor. It's a rumor. And I said, Laura Evans' diaries said that she helped the bootleggers hide booze in these tunnels during Prohibition. He goes, oh, rumor, rumor. So the Chamber of Commerce and the museum share a building. And so when I was talking with the man, I was getting ready to leave. One of the women at the Chamber of Commerce goes, come here. And she slips me a piece of paper. She goes, you need to call me. Be quiet. So I left. So I called her up that night and she said, look, I know where there's one building that has an open tunnel. She says, you cannot use my name because me and my friends broke into the building to do a seance on Halloween night in the tunnel with a Ouija board. And I don't want to get in trouble. But here's the address and here's what it looks like. So I went to the address the next day and I was like, hey, I'm looking for tunnels. I'm writing this book on Laura Evans. And he goes, oh, yeah, sure. Come here. So he hands me a flashlight and he takes me down to the basement. Now, I had no clue what I was supposed to be looking at. I didn't know what these tunnels were, nothing. Takes me into the basement, wooden old original floor. And he says, see, there's a big, huge wooden door at the end. He goes, open the door. Here's the flashlight. And I open this big, huge wooden door. I stepped in and I'm looking up at this 6 foot tall, 5 foot wide tunnel, sidewalks above my head. It went the whole length of the street. I had no clue what I was looking at. but it was so cool. I was like, oh, I want to know all about this thing. This is neat. And so I just was in love right there. I thought that was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I felt like Indiana Jones. And I was like, you know what? I want to find the rest of these.
Oh, Tracy, thank you so much. This is fascinating.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was CityCast Denver host Bree Davies speaking with author Tracy Beach.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all for today's Morning Magazine. Special thanks to Stacy Johnson, Benita Lee, Alexis Kenyon, and Bree Davies for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. If you'd like to comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower and Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Longo-Better. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.